And we're live. Thank you very much for your time. Hope you had a great lunch. Thanks for joining us for our second session today in the Azure track about open source. Just by show of hands, who joined us for the first session earlier this morning? Oh, excellent. Thank you very much. We're not going to go through the same content again, but we do want to provide a little bit of context for everyone joining this session. My name is Jose Miguel Parrella. I'm an open source product manager with the Azure team. I'm joined by some of my colleagues in Azure engineering, as well as by one of our partners. I was going to share with you a little bit of what we're doing in the open source space in the cloud. This morning, we talk about application platform and how all the open source goodness coming out of our Microsoft open source journey is coming together as a number of benefits for you developers working with the application platform. And this afternoon, we wanted to focus a little bit on data. Again, to set a little bit of context for everyone, in the cloud, when we look at all the industry trends and what our customers and developers are telling us, we look at open source driving innovation in a number of use cases and scenarios, such as next generation architectures driven by containers, managed services, DevOps, and IoT, where all of these things running Linux and BSD are connecting to the cloud, and we're able in the cloud to provide them with a platform to enhance the value they deliver. And we have a number of use cases. This morning we didn't talk about the four things below. But again, in our Azure GitHub repository, you're going to find GitHub Pages side that talks about these four use cases in detail. So if you're interested in learning how open source components come together to form each one of these kind of like architectural patterns, we sure have some content to share there with you. So this is the reason why we are talking more and more about open source in the cloud. We have a very unique approach in Azure. For those of you that have seen Mark Rusinovich talk at All Things Open last year or the Open Compute Project Summit this year, you've heard him talking about our approach to open source, and we're going to share a vision video towards the end of the session that kind of puts it together for everyone. Now, in the data platform, just like in the application platform, we have first-party and third-party offerings in the open source space. When we talk about our data platform first-party offerings for open source developers, we're talking about, for example, connectivity. When you look at our SQL Server, where it's running on Windows, or in the future as a technical preview running on Linux, Azure SQL Database, and other offerings, we're looking to activate the drivers and mechanisms for non-Microsoft developers, people using PHP, people using Node.js, people using Java and Linux, to connect to the database. And that means parity in terms of the features that we want to offer for each one of those mechanisms. And for everyone here that has tried to connect the PHP ORM to Microsoft SQL Server, you probably know the struggle, and you probably know exactly what we're talking about. And this has been a journey. We recently announced a preview of our new Linux ODBC driver, runs for the first time on Ubuntu. In the past, it only ran on Red Hat Enterprise, Linux, and SUSE. So those are the kind of transformations that we're going through. It's not just about SQL, though, and we don't want to make this conversation a conversation about SQL, but as of this morning, we have published a new parse server template in Marketplace. And this is a great example of another way to enable our first-party data platform for open source developers. Parse server, Node.js based, open source developers love it. We now have a solution that runs entirely in app service. It's available in the marketplace. And this solution is powered by DocumentDB. Again, another first party offering by Microsoft that connects, thanks to all this connectivity goodness, connects with an open source solution. If you want to learn more about how we're doing it, join the session tomorrow in room 2001 down the hall. We're going to be talking a little bit more about DocumentDB and how we are connecting it with solutions such as Parse. So it's not just about first party. I wanted to update you on that. But we've seen a very strong momentum on third-party data offerings in Azure. Just the second half of 2015, we had over 30 new features and disclosures coming out just in the open source space for Azure. That means more than one per week. If you follow the Azure blog, you've known it, right? And you know that we have this marketplace templates coming out. We have this, the Docker driver for Azure files and a new version of this or that particular product. And here's just a sample of how those solutions come together. If you look, for example, at relational databases, NoSQL and caching, as well as in the big data space, things like ingestion management, security, and access, we have a number of these open source solutions coming together to offer what customers and what developers need as well. All of these solutions have today marketplace templates. They use many mechanisms, such as Azure Resource Manager, which we're going to talk about in just a second. And if you put this together with our first-party offerings, now you have a constellation of open source data solutions and opportunities for you to build this data platform. To do that, we really rely on open APIs, open SDKs, and certainly technologies like Azure Resource Manager. It is critical that those foundations are really strong when it comes to openness, you know, vendor independence, and access for third parties. And I want to invite on stage David, who's a program manager in the Azure team focusing on developer experience and one of the strongest advocates for open source APIs at Microsoft, for some information and quick demo as well.
Thank you, Jose.
Thank you.
Thank you to everybody who was part of the first session. And in this session, we're going to do a little bit of a deeper dive into SDKs and into the APIs themselves. We're going to look at some foundations that we're building into the Azure APIs that are based in open source. So Azure has, for Azure's management APIs, we took the bet on something called the Open API specification. The Open API specification, you may also know it by its other name, Swagger. So Swagger is a JSON or YAML-based specification format for REST APIs. Not just REST APIs, but HTTP APIs. It's kind of a first principles approach to saying, hey, here's the definition of where my endpoints are, here are the data types that I pass back and forth, and this is what you can expect from my JSON API. Why we chose that is more based on its acceptance in the community. So when we look at all these different API structures, and we look at first-party and third-party data services, what really makes them powerful is some of our first-party services will have the same API as a third-party service. So you can use an ODBC driver. You can write SQL against a database, and you can expect to execute roughly that same SQL against another database. This kind of baseline and standardization allows us to take advantage and build tools that span across all these different areas. And span not just vendors, but span across the entire technology space. And Open API Initiative, or Swagger, had recently become a Linux Foundation project. And this is a Linux Foundation project that is community driven. It has a community board of directors. We are embracing it, and we are trying to be a part of this as the spec progresses. But it's a community-driven approach, and we're very proud to be part of it. We're looking at creating, evolving, and promoting a vendor-neutral API. That is what the Swagger specification is for. And as we look at how it works with our APIs and then further down the line with our SDKs, I think we'll get a better idea here. So we start off with Open API and our REST specifications. This describes our schema in an open standard that anyone can take advantage of. And then we introduce a tool called AutoREST. AutoREST is a code generator. There's also another open source project, the Swagger code generator. We decided that we were going to introduce this code generator to help us produce SDKs that better fit our particular idiosyncrasies in our API. So the specification, the Swagger specification, or the Open API specification, allows for vendor extensions. So it allows us to specify some extra information in there, still corresponding to the specification, but it gives us a little bit more of a vendor-specific enhancement, if you will. And then what this leads to is us generating out code for all of these different languages across Azure. So instead of seeing C# advancing faster than Java, Java is advancing at the same speed as C#. Python functionality will be the same as C#. Everything is at that same level. We're leveling the playing field across our SDKs, and this is introducing a lot more opportunity to work across these different languages. So when we start to think about that, what does that get us? So we're going to go in and do a little demo here of our API specifications, and there's lions and fish. I'm going to start off in the portal. So here, you can see I have a handful of resource groups. Probably can't see that well. Now you can see. So I have a handful of resource groups, nothing special here. I'm going to go in and, well, let's take a look at our REST API specifications. So in GitHub, under the Azure organization, we have a repository where we store all of our specifications for our REST APIs. You are welcome to go out there, to dig into them, to use them, to do whatever you like. What is the anatomy of one of these specifications? Let's just take a look really quick at, how about Azure Storage? This is a good one. I'm gonna take the raw here. There. Better visualization for JSON here. Okay. So, this is what a Swagger specification looks like. You have your schemas, consumes, produces, security definitions. And one thing that we are going to look into really quick is our security definitions. So our security for AAD here is just OAuth 2. We are going to use OAuth 2 with an implicit flow to get a token from our API, from Azure Active Directory for our own user, and then we're going to use that token to interact with the APIs from a curl and from the web browser. So let's get into doing that. All right, so you can go out to azure.github.io right now, and you will see this site. At that site, you will find a bunch of information about SDKs, CLIs. Go out and explore, and then you can drop over to the APIs themselves. So here we can see a list of APIs. So we have Resource Manager, we have Azure Subscriptions, Provider Features, Management Locks, Role-Based Authentication, Storage, Network, Compute. We have all of our APIs out there. You can jump into Resource Manager, and you can see, okay, I want to see resource groups. We expand out resource groups, and we can jump into a GET. So. I'm going to grab the API API version and subscription, and I'm going to try it out. Oh no, I got a 401. Web codes, 401, unauthorized. So you can't just go and make a REST API call to Azure Management APIs. It doesn't work like that. You need to authorize first. So we hop out to the authorize. And now this is gonna take us out to Azure Active Directory, to the Azure Common Tenant. And hopefully if all goes well, I do not know why that's doing that. Is that still?
that's fine. That's really annoying. This. Yeah, let's do this. Okay, so here we're going to show it on video, because we're having some AV difficulties, and I apologize for that. So we're logging in right now and redirected in. Now you can see you'll have to accept the application. All we want to do is just read your profile. Just know that you are you, and then we'll offer you again the ability to go and list your providers. From there, you can see what metadata the API expects. You'll be requested for it. You can get the your subscription from going into Azure CLI or going into the portal, wherever it makes sense for you. After you fill it in, you'll try it out. You will actually get a response. And there's the body of the response that actually comes back from the management APIs. And now, if you look, we took that curl and we've just pasted it into our session. We're gonna run that through JQ and out comes pretty JSON. So that bearer token was in the authorization header. We used it in our curl that requested from the API, and it was just a get. You could do puts, posts, whatever you want. That's all defined in the Swagger document, all built on a foundation of open source, and the tool that shows that is another open source project. That's Swagger UI. All of this is all built on open source. We may have tweaked a little bit of the CSS, but that's it. It's all those technologies, and the interop between those technologies is really what makes this play well. So that's why we chose that path, and I hope that this makes sense and you see the power in it in the same way we do. So without further ado, Boris, I'd like to welcome you to the stage. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Boris Baryshnikov. As Jose introduced me at the beginning, I'm a program manager on the Azure Compute team working on Linux open source. And before we actually jump into a live demo that Ben is gonna be presenting, I'm gonna give you a couple of examples of things that we're doing and things that are being enabled by the fact that we're working with open APIs. We're supporting Linux firsthand in terms of what you can run on Azure. And a couple of things you can see in here. So a couple of data-related products that are open source-related products you can deploy on Azure is various data solutions. So in this case is a sample of the MariaDB cluster. So MariaDB cluster is one of the marketplace offers, and there's a template solution for that as well that allows you to deploy a MariaDB version of the database on the Azure. On the Microsoft Azure. So in this case, the deployment itself, the picture is the combination of the load balancer that sits in front of the three replicas that could be individual nodes in the Azure, individual VMs. And in this case, so once you provision this cluster, once you provision the solution through the marketplace, which is the combination of the Azure Resource Management APIs and the standard APIs that David was demoing just now, and after that, you have a MariaDB cluster running on Azure, and you can use it in any website or any other applications that might be using MySQL-like compatible relational agent running on the Microsoft Azure. So this would run on your Microsoft Azure subscription, and this would provide the data endpoint, MySQL compatible data endpoint, in this case, MariaDB endpoint for your application. So the second piece, the second example I would like to briefly go over is availability of the Elk Stack solution. So this is the Elasticsearch Kibana, Elasticsearch and the Elasticsearch connector for the Hadoop style workload. So normally in the open source land, we see a lot of different distribution, a lot of different products you can be using for processing your big data or Hadoop distributions that could include Cloudera, Hortonworks, Microsoft Azure native HD Insight or things like that. But while you can process all this data on the left-hand side, so that's the bottom slide, left-hand side in yellow, So you still need to put a search on top of that large amount of data. And Elasticsearch and Kibana are the two tools, is the part of the stack that you can be using, again, deploying on Azure and being able to use it from Azure against any of the data stacks, any of the Hadoop or big data stacks you may be running on Azure or elsewhere. So that's what will provide you capability, and that's what enables you to use innovation that happens in the open source, right, directly on the Azure. So the screenshot on the right, the Elasticsearch in Kibana is the so-called solution template that you can find in the marketplace. So this is azure.com/marketplace. And then you follow through the standard UIs of deploying a solution to the Microsoft Marketplace. You will be able to connect it to any data sources and perform the search and use Kibana for the visualization of your data. So again, those are a couple of examples that we have in the marketplace today that heavily rely on the fact that we do support Linux as the first party on the Azure, and that we work with lots of APIs that are open APIs or industry standard APIs, and you able to use and deploy those solutions interacting with a number of open source tools and products available to you. So with that, let me introduce our partner, Ben Lackey from DataStax, and Ben is gonna show us a couple of things that we doing with Azure Open Source.
Okay.
All right, good luck.
Thanks, Boris. Hi, I'm Ben Lackey. I'm with DataStax. I've been working with the Azure org for about a year now, so figuring out ways we can get DataStax to work on Azure. For my talk, I'm gonna cover a couple different things. So I'll talk a bit about DataStax and Cassandra, the open source product that we're the commercial entity behind, talk a bit about what's available on Marketplace and what other Azure artifacts are available, and then finally point you at some resources that might be interesting if you want to go try this yourself. So with that, Cassandra is this thing that came out of really two papers. There's the Google Bigtable paper, and there's the Amazon Dynamo paper. And some engineers at Facebook sort of looked at A and B and thought about it and came up with what they viewed as the best of both. Really unique in terms of ability to scale to millions and millions of transactions a second in the database, and also never, ever go down. So Cassandra is incredibly unique, as far as I'm aware, in being geographically distributed. So you can run a database, and I'll show you this a bit later, with data centers in East US, Central US, and West US, and it's one cohesive database. Keeps everything in sync and works. So that's Apache Cassandra. Talking a bit more about that, the database scales really, really well because of its architecture. Every node is the same. There's no idea of like an active or a passive node, or maybe sharding nodes out, disaster recovery. Instead, all nodes are live, all nodes are the same, and they're all active. What this means is that your clients can connect to literally any node and interact with the database. Really, really good for transactional database applications. So these are things where you have many, many users coming in, performing individual reads or writes on the database. We characterize that as slightly different from analytics use cases, things databases like Hadoop are really, really good at. So to characterize that a bit further, in this diagram, we have a read that's come in to a particular node. That node is acting as the coordinator, in our terms, for that transaction. And then it picks another node that it's gonna write a replica to. In the first case, it tries one node that's down, no problem, retries another node, and this succeeds. And this is kind of the core of what Cassandra does. Deals with application failures really well, deals with hardware failures, node failures, even entire data centers going down. So I mentioned a bit, DataStax is the commercial entity behind Cassandra. So we add on to Cassandra in a couple ways. We support the open source community and do a large number of commits to the Apache project. At the same time, we offer a commercial product called DataStax Enterprise. And this offers a few things beyond what you can find in the open source offering. One of the most interesting is we actually bundle in Apache Spark. So if you want to use Cassandra in conjunction with things like Spark MLlib, we provide a really nice persistence layer to go behind that. Similarly, we have very tight integration with Solr. So if you want to have your transactional database and then do text search on top of that, very, very helpful that way. Chances are if you open up your mobile phone today and you have, you enter in some plain text search, behind a fair number of those applications is DataStax Enterprise running today with Apache Cassandra as the persistence layer behind. Beyond that, we do a bunch of the things open source companies typically do. We offer support, we offer certified builds, basically assurance that if you're using DataStax Enterprise, you can be guaranteed this is something that an enterprise can consume and will be reliable. Okay, two more slides and then we go to demo, but these are really cool. So I mentioned this idea that that DataStax and Cassandra are always up, always on. One of the best illustrations of that is one of our customers, Netflix, has open sourced a framework they call Chaos Monkey. And what Chaos Monkey does is basically it runs around your data center unplugging things. And they do this in production. And this gives an idea of just how reliable the database is. The thinking behind it is rather than planning for a DR event and maybe once every 6 months invoking DR and just testing it's working, you should be able to handle failures all the time. And that tests it. The other one I really like is this graph up here on the right, this sort of multicolored tiered thing. And what that shows is one of our customers going live in production for the first time. So it's over a day, different geographical regions coming online for the first time and serving this application. Whole thing went off without a hitch, geographically distributed multi-regional database handling the application. That's what we're really good at. A couple more similar graphs. The ones on the left showing millions of operations per second, reliable SLAs there. So kind of what you would expect from a large database. The really boring line, the diagonal line, is kind of why you would use DataStax, linear scale. So the fact that it has no curve to it is huge. You can add many, many nodes. You can start out at 5 nodes. You can go to hundreds, even thousands of nodes. And the database will scale up the amount of data it holds, the number of transactions it can serve, linearly. And that's down to a bunch of the architectural choices going on further down, basically where there's no idea of a load balancer, nothing sitting in front. It's huge. I don't really know of much else like it. So that's it for the slide part. At this point, I'm going to press a button, and we're going to go over to the marketplace. And yes, it worked. Good. OK, so this is the Azure portal. You guys have probably seen this before. And we have a marketplace offer. I'm going to take us through spinning that up, and then I'm going to do the kind of Julia Child thing where we switch over to a cluster I've already built, because it takes about 20 minutes for one of these to run. So if you search for DataStax Enterprise in the marketplace, you'll only see this guy. The one below's for our QA. And you see a description of what it is and what you can do. If I hit create here, it pulls up the blade and the offer. And we've tried to keep this very simple. What we've noticed about Azure Marketplace is it's often users coming to DataStax for the first time. They just want something to play around with. They don't need all the bells and whistles. So I'm going to enter in a username, a password, re-enter my password, and call this like Ben Marketplace 50 or something. Hit OK. And this is really all it asks me for. How many nodes do I want and what kind of machine do I want to do? We're really big on performance, so we don't recommend things like the Azure A-Series. We tend to skew towards SSDs and that sort of thing. Azure has some really great options for SSDs. The G and D-Series machines, really well suited for DataStax kind of workloads. So all I do is hit OK. It performs its validation, says that's passed, and hit OK again, and hit create, and then it goes away and it deploys the database. And that's how easy it is to get, in this case, it's a 6-node cluster up and running on Azure. So as I mentioned, I already have one of those running. So this is our administrative interface. It's called Ops Center, and it lets you see the cluster and sort of see what it's doing. Probably the coolest part about that is I can go see the ring that represents the database, and in this case, it's the different IP addresses for all the different machines in there. I can click on them and see what the individual nodes are doing and how they're interacting. So that's what's available within the marketplace. Outside of the marketplace, we have some other templates that can do more complex deployments. And I mentioned earlier, one of the big things about Cassandra is this whole geographical redundancy thing. So this is a database deployed using the Azure Resource Manager templates that has 30 nodes, 10 in East US, Central US, and West US. The idea here is you could lose an entire data center and the database would keep running. In fact, depending on what consistency levels you chose, maybe you could even lose 2 data centers. And that's one of the really neat things about Cassandra is you can tune consistency. So if you want to be really, really consistent, you can require a large number of nodes to be up and running. But if you want to be more on the available side, maybe you allow reads and writes to happen if a smaller number of nodes are available. It's up to you, and it varies application to application. Right, so that's Ops Center. If you spin one of these things up, the way you typically interact with it for the first time might well be the command line. So you can SSH into one of the nodes and sort of play around with that. So that's one of the nodes in our database. I'm trying to remember if this is the 6-node or the 30-node one, but we can find out in a minute. The templates we have are using Ubuntu. We run on Red Hat as well, just whatever Linux flavor you want, really. So this is DC0VM8. It looks like the node I ended up at. And that sort of drives one thing home. I don't even really know slash care which node I'm on. I'm on the 8th node. It's just as good as the 6th or 9th node. So if I type a command node tool status in here, it'll give me a description of what this node thinks the database looks like. So you can see this is our 30 node cluster. So 10 nodes in each of these, different racks within those, and so on. Okay, so that's kind of admin tools, that's all fine. It's a database. Maybe you actually want to do something with the database. So the way you interact with the database in Cassandra is CQL shell, Cassandra query language. And that's effectively a stripped down version of general purpose SQL. There are a number of things that are in SQL that don't work well if you run them over 1,000 nodes. So we make some decisions there. Various things I can do. Describe my key spaces. So a key space is effectively a table space. So I basically just have the system ones in here, and then that Ops Center admin interface showed you earlier, it actually stores its data in the database itself. So if I say I want to use that key space, I can then operate on that. So I can do things like describe the key space I just chose to use. Okay, and this tells me about all the various columns within that key space. Similarly, I can do a very SQL-like query on that database. And I see OpsCenter's been shut down, then it started up, then it shut down, then it started up. I guess the repair service is, oh, yeah, repair service isn't running. That sort of makes sense. So this is one way to interact with the database. Beyond that, we have a bunch of different language drivers, Java, .NET, Python, all the sorts of things you'd expect. Okay, so that's largely the demo I had prepared. Beyond that, I want to draw your attention to a couple resources if this looks interesting to you and you want to give it a try. One thing is all the templates, all the ARM templates we developed for this are up here. And this even includes the ones on the marketplace. So you can go over here to GitHub and see what's going on the marketplace behind that deployment you did. Similarly, you can do much, much more complicated deployments like the multi-data center one I mentioned. We're working on being able to attach a configurable number of premium storage disks and various things like that. This is constantly changing and constantly being improved, and we have incorporated pull requests from the community as well, which has been great. So that's kind of getting deployed and set up. One other thing, once you do have a database deployed and want to make use of it, we offer a bunch of training courses. These are online training courses, all free, available on demand anytime. And we actually offer a path through that. I think it's 5 different training courses you take. And then at the end, O'Reilly has a certification you can take if you want to be a DataStax certified developer, DataStax certified administrator. Really great path if you're looking to go through all this. My very last thing on the administrative side, we have a deployment guide up at the same website, academy.datastax.com. It describes best practices for deploying on Azure, do's and don'ts, and there's a lot of interesting things on there, things about why you should use SSDs rather than spinning disks, recommendations for how to configure the network, and so on. So, okay. That's what I'd had prepared. Am I handing back to you, Boris, or Jose? Okay,
yes.
There's Jose.
The guy with the box. So I'll put this here. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I think this is really awesome that we have access to this technology on the marketplace. And I did want to put it all, put it together, kind of like these two sessions by just checking out this video from Mark Rusinovich, our CTO, talking a little bit about, I guess a thumbnail is not the most, all right, he'll forgive me. So it's just a brief conversation on this open source journey for cloud innovation. It talks, a little bit about everything we have, from containers to DevOps. So let's just roll it.
I think the fundamental disruption that the cloud is creating is based on instant access to compute and infinite storage. So open source is a first-class citizen on Azure. In fact, that's been one of the guiding principles of Azure now for many years. Our culture has been transforming and embracing open source across lots of different vectors in Azure. When you take a look at the cloud world, SOA architectures are just too slow and monolithic for the kind of rapid innovation and evolution of applications that's necessary today. Well, so when we sat down, we heard lots of customers saying they wanted some kind of container service, the ability to deploy Docker containers to Azure. And when we looked around at our alternatives, build something ourselves, take something from open source, it became clear that those customers that actually had containers in production were largely running Mesos. Mesos, proven technology, open standard, basically open community, right? De facto standard now for large scale clusters of containers and microservices. And so we decided to work closely with Mesos, who we'd already worked with in the past, to develop our container service using open source technologies out of the box. And that gave us a few things. One, obviously the innovations of the open source community go right into our container service. Another one is that those customers that do adopt Mesos have this portability and flexibility of an application that runs in their own environment. They can easily move up into Azure using our Azure Container as a Service, or vice versa, dev test in the cloud and bring it back on-prem. So we just saw a lot of advantages of not going to roll it ourselves, but really working with the community and technologies that have already gotten a lot of momentum and we heard a lot of customers asking for. A single developer with just a small pocketbook of budget can go and do projects like this that used to cost millions of dollars 5 years ago. So this is one of the things I'm especially proud of, is Microsoft isn't just playing lip service to open source or taking open source and then putting it in a behind a black box and never giving back to the community. We are embracing what is the true nature of open source, which is community. And so that means that we're contributing back any innovations that we make to open source projects. We're one of the top contributors to Docker, for example. We're one of the top contributors to Hadoop, for example. We've also introduced an MVP program for open source. So MVPs get recognized for their expertise in open source and helping the community run open source technologies on top of Azure. We're pushing all our source code for our SDKs and our client libraries up into GitHub and allowing the community to make contributions to it. So that's part of the culture that we've developed inside of Microsoft. It also means first-class support, which includes making sure our support engineers are all well-versed in Linux and other open source technologies. It means things like partnerships with Red Hat, where our engineers are sitting next to their engineers to support Red Hat Linux on top of Microsoft, things that where people couldn't imagine it just a few years ago. So it's really across the board, a big cultural transformation over the last few years at Microsoft, embracing open source deeply across the whole stack.
I wanted to invite Boris and David up the stage and take a few questions. There are two mics right here, and if you are gonna ask a question, just wave because we cannot see you.
Maybe there are questions for data stacks.
And questions for data stacks.
Sorry.
Cultural trend.
That's right. All right. Any questions? We have data stacks in the marketplace, so you can search that.
Hello. I want to know the price how to come for use the Cassandra in the HR platform. Is the price how to, is by instance or by license or?
Sure. So the Azure Marketplace offer is bring your own license. It's free for development and non-production use. If you want to use it in production, you would have to work with our team to procure a license. Similarly, if you wanted support for non-production use, you would have to procure a license.
So maybe the other way to answer this question, to try it out, it's the cost of compute resources in Azure. That's right. What you're going to be paying for spinning up. So if you're spinning G5 VMs, 40 of them or 50 of them, you're paying respectively price of those VMs for, which is actually a lot. So that's why I'm bringing up. G5 is one of the largest VMs we have. It's the 32-core VM with a half a terabyte of RAM. So definitely don't recommend that for the development purposes. Although, it's your budget, so.
Yeah. Good point, good distinction.
Any other questions, comments, feedback? We can barely see you because we have lights going in the face, so
yeah.
We cannot see if people have questions or have hands. You can just shout out.
Go ahead.
Feel free to reach out to any of us. If you see us passing, you have questions, you want to take them one off, just come ask. We're always open to them.
There's another resource we don't put on slides because then we tend to get a lot of love mail. But opensource@microsoft.com is an email address available for any questions. We'll route them in the vast network of open source enthusiasts within Microsoft. So any questions, that's the email available to you.
Let me actually reverse it because you don't want to ask us questions, so we're going to ask you questions. How many of you are using open source by show of hand in production? In production. All right, so probably half or more, maybe 75% of the room, so that's good. How many of you are using various data solutions on open source? How many of you are actually using open source on Azure? A little bit fewer. Do you have a feedback? Is it a good thing to do or is it a bad thing to do? All right, do you have feedback? So is it good? All right, so some of you are good, but I guess others maybe not so good. We are welcome your feedback. So definitely, if you have concerns, things how they run on Azure, or if you cannot run something, or you're having problem running something, definitely let us know. So part of our teams, I guess, represented here from Microsoft, is actually making sure that all things you have seen do run great. And one of the strategies which we were talking about extensively at the very first half of this two-session talk is we want you to use your expertise, your developers who know a particular technology, and not necessarily Microsoft technology in this case. So we are welcoming you to Azure. And a variety of things you see is basically that's the thing we want you to try it out.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, so hi guys, I'm a Microsoft employee, by the way, and I have a lot of customers that are having some problems with Linux VMs that they're losing the cloud init scrape at the initialization, and they're losing the HTTP, and the machine are getting IP, or the SSH service is not running, and they can't connect to the boxes. Those are common problems to the Linux Ubuntu, for example, VMs, and is there any way or things to do when something like that happens in terms of the VM doesn't get an IP or the SSH services is not running, or because this is not about Azure itself, it's about the software that runs into the VM that comes with the distribution. So
yeah. We have a Linux support team that looks into those things, and for some of the most common cases we've developed extensions, so there's a VM access right. extension to reset the SSH credentials, for example. Yeah, we do have a number of people, as our partnership with Red Hat as well, we've onboarded a number of other Linux engineers as well.
So, if, for example, one of my clients reset the IPO tables, and he doesn't get any access to the
right.
VM because he said,
right.
you know, so, he did something wrong, so sure. The only choice is to download the VM, fix the problem, and unload the VM again, or what?
So in the case of troubleshooting, so I guess that's a little bit longer and a higher level question, I'm gonna pop it up. So you have, there's a number of troubleshooting tools in the Azure portal that you can use to be able to provision. So which group are you showing us? I'm just using
your
portal.
Oh, I just want to point that out. I don't know if everyone saw our deployment just finished. So we
Yay.
Have a new cluster.
All right.
Anyway.
But so what it was after is, that, let's say, you're looking at the resources, and so there are a number of things you can do in here. So you can look at the the audit logs and the troubleshooting logs. So one of the things that we have added in the portal specifically is an ability to actually view the boot logs for the Linux VM. So you can actually, if the VM doesn't boot or if it loses things like access, basically you cannot get on the VM to look at the logs. You could look at the boot diagnostics in here, which, so in this case, because it's a deployment from a template, it's not installed, but if you have that installed, which gets installed by default on the VMs you normally run in Azure, you can get a screenshot of the console log for the Linux VM, or you can get actually the text of the console log and see what's going wrong. So we also have a number of extensions. So extension is a mechanism that you can run code on top of the VM to do something with the VM. So one question people ask is like, if I cannot access a VM, how does it happen that you can? So the platform itself has a way of actually connecting to the machine and trying to execute the code of the extension. This is how a VM access extension works. So this is how you can reset the password if you can run VM extension with the new credentials being put on the machine. So the fabric, the backend componentry will connect to the guest on that VM and will put additional credentials, whatever the password or the SSH key you're using for Linux machine, and then you can get back to the machine and continue troubleshooting. So those are the few things that you can do. And obviously, you can go and file a support request if you cannot troubleshoot that yourself, and that's kind of the other avenue of trying it out. So one of the things you see on the very, very top page, and again, I'm using Ben's portal. So the default use usually have a help and support in here, and you can just say new support request and clicked the wrong thing. So new support request, file out the information, what kind of issue you have, and just let our support handle it. So
and
that's
I'll also add that we do get requests for that interactive console, and that's
right.
something that we're aware of. And on feedback.azure.com, if you search for Linux console, there's a thread going on there that you can follow for any updates on that.
Right.
So I did want to,
Well, the Azure provides some monitor mechanism for to monitor the Azure VPN's bandwidth. Because we encounter one situation, we have two rings to synchronize the data, but we now use the high performance VPN gateway, and the bandwidth is, we use all the bandwidth, and the data synchronization is stuck. So we don't know what happened. We only take the issue to the Microsoft, and you say, you use the bandwidth out of the bandwidth, but we don't know why. So will you provide a mechanism let us to monitor the bandwidth between two data centers?
So I guess let me reinterpret the question. So you're using you're using VPN gateways between VNets or between different data centers, and you got into the case when you used up the full bandwidth available between the two VPN gateways, right?
Yeah.
So, but you do not have visibility into where and when or how that bandwidth got used. So I guess we can follow up offline. This is more technical than I guess generally useful. So one thing that we were actually working with Ben, so one of those things that you've seen, the multi-DC cluster, is making sure that the different regions can connect to each other at high speed. So we're looking at the different things, and actually I can probably share that little detail. So Ben helps us find some issues that we have in the platform. So he is driving us to make sure that the platform provides what he expects of the platform to be able to have those nodes in three different clusters. So I don't have immediate answer for your question, but we can follow up offline after the session.
Okay, so we've currently migrating our platform from AWS to Azure, and one of the things that we found is that, for example, we had network problems where the bandwidth from a machine would be terrible. And when we contacted support, it was a known issue with the version of the kernel which we installed, which was actually the standard Ubuntu build. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I found is that communication is not great. If it is a known, you know, it's a known version that is not working or it's got issues, we should be notified about that. Is that, you know, are there any plans to do that?
First of all, thank you for feedback. And literally last week, I spent a week in support, so I was actually taking support calls as the support engineer from people. So one thing that was definitely we need improvement on is a unified place where we communicate very technical details of the issues like this. So, and again, we have an Azure block, but Azure block is mostly used for the announcements and the likes, and we do not yet have a good source of information for the technical information of the issues that we are aware about. Like, they're not necessarily issue with the platform, but they may be known issues for the particular things, like, for example, known issue that this set of drivers, or there's an issue with the particular build that you should not be using and wait for the bug to be fixed and things like that. So, again, at the moment right now, I do not have a place to point to, but that's problem was raised, and we'll most likely have either blog or the support dedicated page where you can find things like that. So a traditional mechanism for Microsoft is this support knowledge base articles, supportmicrosoft.com. From in this new world, that appears to be a bit too heavy. So the time it takes to actually publish an article, it counts days. And sometimes we need to publish something really, really fast. So we're looking for just a new avenue to make it happen. Again, I'm not promising anything, but just stating this is understood and acknowledged problem. We just need to find a solution from our
side. That's from my point of view. What I'm looking for is proactiveness. If you know there is a bug with the version of the kernel, and we're using that one, and you guys know that because we actually installed from your system, probably you should be notified. You know, as soon as you find out.
Correct. So as I said, I acknowledge the fact that we do not have a good place as of right now. But literally, there was a bug through unrelated resource that actually affected Cloud Init on Ubuntu, and that affected how Ubuntu VMs. So if you updated the kernel to a quote-unquote broken version, you ended up with the VM being regenerating the host keys. So if you're using strict SSH auth and not allowing the host key changes, you would fail to connect. And again, it's strictly not Azure problem, but Azure is what's affected because it's in the Cloud Init that is unique to Azure. So we have internal communications with it, but we have no public place to put this out. So as I said, problem understood.
All right.
Thank you.
I think this is a moment to remind everyone to please submit your feedback. It's really important. And really, I mean, thanks to our partners and thanks to everyone of you that decided to start Build just after the keynotes to come to two open source sessions. If you have a little token of our appreciation to you, just this open source t-shirts and little Microsoft Linux penguins so you can grab them as they last. Really appreciate your time today. Hope you enjoy the rest of Build and keep sending your feedback and your input. We're really powered by the community. Thank you so much.
Thank you.